morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you're consuming this broadcast. Thank you for tuning in to Bus Talk, a podcast about your life at work, your work-life balance, where we talk about stuff that no one really asks at work. Or even if you had those questions, you dodge them away thinking, oh my God, what perception would it trigger? So the goal of Bus Talk is to just simplify all those complex questions, cut out the mumbo jumbo, and lay it on the table so that you get time to think, rethink, and then reapply whatever that works for you. So on that note, let's jump into today's episode. In continuation to the themes that we have for each month, January was building a robust sales team. February was largely around the mastery of LinkedIn. For sales folks, in March, we are talking about culture code in teams and more specifically sales teams. And in today's episode, we talk about collaboration and communication between teams and within a team, the importance of team collaboration, the communication protocols, challenges, tips and tricks and techniques, which come in the way sometimes and sometimes work really well. How do you build trust and respect among team members, overcoming collaboration challenges, given that everybody's different, and then ultimately fostering a positive culture of feedback and continuous improvement. Of course, I'll touch upon many more points, but these are some of broad overview points that I'll discuss. So sit back, relax, watch where you're walking. If you're on a morning walk, if you're stuck in traffic, put on your headphones, don't disturb the co-passenger if you're on a shared cab, and if you're on a public transport with other people, pretend to be very serious while you listen to this. No, I'm just joking, right? So this is your companion for the next 30 odd minutes. Let's jump right in. So let's get started with the fundamental question. Why do you need collaboration? What can you do without collaboration? I mean, you signed up for the form, for the job. So as did all the five team members. And so everybody should function the way they ought to function. They should function the way they were supposed to. They signed up for it. There's a legally binding contract for them to deliver to the best of their abilities. And for you as a manager to inspect, inspire, instill confidence, as the case might be, and then get the job done. But as you know very well, despite having all these legal bindings and paperwork and everything and the obvious of the obvious, collaboration requires that much more effort. Now, let's first find out why do you need that kind of effort, and then what can you do if your collaboration in inter-team, within the team collaboration is broken. And then we'll also touch a little bit about intra-team, as in you collaborating with another team. So let's first start with your immediate team, your five-member team. They are on board. You struggle to make them gel together. Why? Because they come from different backgrounds, upbringing, selling styles, objection handling styles. Everything is different. And here you can, the risk that you have as a sales manager primarily is to become this collections agent, where you go around the room and ask, how much are you going to get this week? What's your forecast? What's your delivery? If you're in business development or any other function, just equate it with a parallel where you would think that if my job is to just task my team and inspect the work that they do and deliver and then get on to the next task and next inspection, my suspicion there is that you won't really have the best performance. You would wonder why I signed up for it. Here are the prescribed guidelines on what constitutes a good job. And since we're talking about sales and business development, it's very simple. Like, you get to your forecast on every given quarter, month, or week, as much as you deliver, and then you move on to the next week. And that's what we all signed up for. Isn't it good to keep it that simple? But it turns out it just doesn't work like that. And it doesn't work because there are so many moving parts. What could be the variables? Customers are different, situations differ, the mindsets differ. Sometimes there is fatigue, sometimes there are some personal challenges, and so many things that can come in way between this simple thing called attaining your promised deliverable. And so at that point in time, the risk is that the team could default, could fail in its objectives, and you could run the risk of being a failed team. So as a manager, as a people manager, you probably need to foresee what could be the potential derailing potholes that lie ahead. So first, even before you talk about collaboration and communication and fostering team spirit and all that, first, you would, as a manager, you got to chalk out the path, the vision, what you want to do for the year, for the quarter, for the month, for the week, and what could be the anticipated roadblocks. I'll give you an example. Suppose you're in March. There is a Good Friday holiday. It's a long weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But then your year end happens on 31st. And the numbers that you started right at the beginning of March, you suddenly realized that you probably lose 3-4 days in between. So what you thought originally was 22 days, 22 available working days is now down to 17 or 18. And so if you have 17 working days for the month, how do you navigate around those 17 days and ensure that your team still gets to the target? So the first thing as a people manager, you have to have the foresight of where you want the team to head to, at what pace, at what velocity, at what variables to navigate, to avoid, to manage, right? There will be some which you can avoid and some you can't. And if you can't, what's plan B? So this is the part of the initial thinking. Once you have done that, then you communicate that to the team. Say, hey, listen, we have a 17-day month. Here are the challenges. Here is what we need to do. Here is what help is available. And here is where there is a risk element. That's a general conversation. Then you double click and speak with them individually, because some objections that apply to one person may not apply to the other person. So you take 5 different conversations. And it's good when you have a smallish team. If you had a largish team, which is like, suppose you were managing 12 people, it will be a little more difficult to have 12 separate 30-minute conversations to explain the road, but you've got to do it. It's essential. This is over and above the weekly conversation or the overarching group conversation that you have. And so once you talk individually, then you start to sense the real objection that comes out. It could be a people objection, it could be a process objection, it could be a technology objection. As a people manager, are you addressing some of these? Are you being able to solve it? Are you able to make the problem that the person thinks, that the teammate thinks as big, to make it small or appear smaller? Or maybe there's no problem at all, it's just a perception. And once these basics are in place, the basic platform is in place, then helping your teammate understand how to collaborate, communicate, interact better within the team is always helpful, because sometimes there is a top performer who'd rather be left alone. Hey, I know my shit. I know what I'm doing. I don't need to be disturbed. Leave me alone kind of people, versus those people who just need, hey, it's not working out for me. Is there a way you can help? Now, one can argue as a people manager, that's your job to help the member who is not able to do it. But you can't do it 24/7. You can't do it all the time. Sometimes you need the team, sometimes opens up to the peers. So how do you provide an environment or a platform for someone to open up and speak freely within the team? So do you build a culture code around the team? Have you built a culture code around the team? If not, that's a first starting point. And you could have your own culture code. Don't need to follow anybody. Some people follow some of the big, you know, say the Carnegies or the Stephen Coveys or whatever that floats your boat. Create your own. Like, I have one that I've created on my own, which is applicable to a particular team. So you can create something on your own. And from a collaboration standpoint, one of the culture codes could be like the no mushroom rule. And I'll explain what that means. It says that don't treat me like a mushroom kept in the dark and fed with bullshit. You know, so let me know whatever is going on. It's very difficult for me to transcend into your mind and have telepathy on what's going wrong. Be vocal about it. Share it so that I can help you remove those doubts or perceptions that you might have, not just about the business, about your peer, about me, or about the team or company. You have to share it so that one can address it. So it could be a culture code that you want to, you know, keep with your team. What it does is, it's not like an overnight switch. You just write down 5 or 6 culture code points and people start to follow it. It's not like that. You have to imbibe it yourself. You have to demonstrate it yourself. And so, and be persistent about it. If you're convinced, if you're clear, then be persistent about it. And then your team will slowly start to adopt and then adapt it and internalize it. And slowly you will see how the culture fabric is being stitched, the collaboration fabric is being stitched. So the fundamental lesson or takeaway, the importance is that of having open, non-judgmental, clear communication at all times. It's not a one-off thing, it's not a project, it's a way of life. And so sometimes the conversation will be favorable, sometimes unfavorable. And so as a manager, you have to have that maturity to handle uncomfortable conversations, right? Oh, my budgets are too big. My budgets as in targets are too big. Why is X person's target only 50% of my numbers and I'm like so much more? And those are tricky and difficult conversations, but you know that sometimes numbers are basis the region or the accounts or the strata of accounts that you are given. And sometimes there are conversations on appraisals, sometimes difficult conversations on increments, salary increments. People are like, well, I deserve 5%, I deserve 15%, why have I got 5%? And despite me being the top performer and so on and so forth, right? So whole bunch of things, right? So as the fundamental tenet of making a good collaborative team, you as a manager have to provide a platform so that they can communicate more effectively via chat, via in person, meet them every now and then. This day and age of, you know, hybrid work culture, many of people choose to work from home. It is always important to meet in person every now and then. So it helps people to know you more than what they hear you at work. And so once you establish that platform, people communicate with you and then encourage them to communicate with the other team members. So let people know each other a little bit more. Now, how do you get to know people a little better? Ask them about, one of the things that has really worked well is something like a clinic call, right? When you get together almost informally and say, hey, you know, this is what happened over the course of the week. This worked, this did not work. And here is where I struggled. And once it's almost like a therapy session, right? Where people open up and say, hey, I found a very irate customer and how do you deal with it? And, you know, you should set this up as a, you know, monthly thing or a bi-weekly or whatever that frequency of business that you have, so that people can share a whole bunch of doubts which they had to struggle with. And you will see other people will slowly start to chime in. And so these are small things to establish communication or the freedom of communication within the team. So that's the starting point or the importance of team collaboration, is to discuss why collaboration is crucial, why communication is crucial, what happens if this communication is broken or interrupted, perceptions creep in, assumptions creep in, and then that leads to confusion. And so the backbone is communication. The backbone for collaboration is communication. Next. Tools, technologies to enhance collaboration. So what are the tools do you have? Do you have a chat? Do you have a video calling app? Do you have, do you meet in person, or do you email? You know, in the age of instant communication, it is important to have a group chat open. Some of you use WhatsApp, some of you use Zoom, some of you use Skype or Slack or whatever. Idea is to stay connected with the team at all times. When I say at all times, it doesn't mean Saturday 9 p.m. It means Monday through Friday, and give them the space and the freedom to switch off from work. But the tools that you have also play a big role. Sometimes having limited tools leads to a communication breakdown. See, if the backbone is communication for all collaboration to happen, you have to have the right vehicle to enable that communication. And that communication will need the right tools or technologies, not just emails, chats. Even, for example, do you have a filter where if somebody goes rogue and starts talk about religion or something derogatory or something provocative, do you have a tool which blocks out those bad words, as it were, or negative words, if you will? Do you have adequate filtering mechanisms in the tools which ensure that there is no profanities being used, and so on and so forth? So keep the team hygiene in place. So sometimes these things go on to become a linchpin in team collaboration, right? You have to make sure that you have the right tools used the right way to enhance the communication, which then becomes the glue for collaboration. Once these two are done, next is, of course, you get to building trust and respect among members. So when you have these clinic calls and you communicate slowly, people stop feeling little more comfortable and stop feeling threatened by their peer. There is this insecurity, especially in competitive organizations. If I do well, what will happen? If I don't do well, oh my God, how is this person? Oh, they got better accounts, better region, da-da-da. And so they just got lucky. And so it's always easy to see somebody's success as a fluke. Whereas when you see somebody else's success as a fluke, you're automatically painting yourself as a victim. And so it is important for you as a people manager to intervene and say and reset that and appreciate why somebody has done well. And a word of caution for some of you managers, I know in the pursuit of appreciating a team member or an effort, people just go to town. I mean, seriously, man, I have seen emails where the guy is just, you know, barely managed to get, you know, 90% or whatever, where the average floor target was, attainment was, say, 100-105%. And this person just went to town saying, look, he at least has done 90% and everything. I'm like, you want to not be super critical about it, that the person missed his numbers? That's fair. But you don't like mark the World Wide Web and let them know that how great that 90% is. Or if a customer has just said, you know, good work after something, absolutely appreciate it. But it's not something that that needs to get blown up out of proportions. Of course, I know, Kamesh, she's a customer writing a mail of appreciation in two words, that's a big deal. Of course, it's a big deal if it's coming from a marquee customer, if it's coming from a customer who's traditionally been very hostile or you have turned around a customer. Those are nice stories to share. All I'm saying is, if it is BAU, then absolutely you can appreciate. I know of someone who was super persistent in terms of mobilizing the internal teams to get the deal revenue recognized. And so the heavy lifting technically should have ended when the customer said, yes, let's go ahead. But as you guys all know, that once the customer says yes, that is the beginning of a new chapter for you, where there is contracting, there is legal, there is paperwork, there's a whole bunch of things, including it doesn't end till even the CRM reflects it correctly. And so there are, the bigger the organization, the multiple stages it goes through, even after the customer says, yes, I'm happy to, you know, sign the PO. And so here was this person who went to town to mobilize, galvanize people, and some of these teams sat across many places across the world. So he had to stay up late at night, early in the morning, over the weekend, and a whole bunch of things he did to mobilize. And then what happened? Eventually the deal did get closed and all credit due. Then the person, the manager said, well, good job done, which was good, but probably it need not have been shared across, you know, World Wide Web, because they said, yeah, we all are doing the same thing. Yeah, the system needs a better improvement, perhaps, but that is BAU. But to the manager, it was important because the person really made sure that he did not drop the ball. So that was important. And so it is important to help your other teammates realize the heavy lifting this person did and appreciate them for doing the same as well, but also strike a balance between not getting so overboard by reporting or highlighting BAU to skip levels and, you know, to your peers, to 300 other people. That sometimes seems like a bit of a show off and not really, you know, a joy of sharing, if you know what I mean. So you build trust by sharing the real stories, the human side of your team member, like, you know, beyond the hard salesperson or business development or professional this person is. Here are the three things they are trying. Here is something which you can take help, especially those who are not doing too well. They need that inspiration from time to time, that comfort that they're not left alone. See, they might not be doing well in that given situation, but they're not bad resources. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been hired, isn't it? And so sometimes building trust that, hey, don't worry, you will get there, motivating them and celebrating each other's success, you know, developing that culture that if somebody's done well, has cracked a big deal, then absolutely be thrilled about it, right? As if you've won the deal. And so if you start feeling good about somebody else's success, it will come back to you. It is seldom or rarely the case where you've been very genuinely happy, right? Not cosmetically happy. That you will find a lot, the cosmetic happiness. Oh my God, you're wearing such a nice dress. Oh my God, you look very good. Oh my God, that's such a good job done. And basically they're not really happy underneath it. And so sometimes being genuinely appreciative about someone's hard work always comes back to you in some way or the other. It's not like a give and take relationship, just to be clear, that, oh, I will be happy for you, so I expect you to be happy for me. It develops over a period of time. It's something that you just give and not really, and I'm getting a bit philosophical here, but the fact is, it's true, right? It's not a deal that you're doing. It's a culture that you're building. It's a fabric that you're building, saying, well, be happy for somebody's success. In general, in life, if somebody is doing well, good for them, right? Be happy if somebody's feeling happy. It's a nice thing to do. If somebody returns that back to you by being happy for your success, then that's added bonus. But don't get sad or derailed that, oh my God, I was so happy for her success, but she was not, or he was not. That might get you into wrong space. So idea is to be happy internally. It starts internally. Once you have made peace, being happy about what you're doing, because remember, or remind yourself, that your definition of success need not be somebody else's definition of success, and vice versa. Their definition of success could be driving a BMW. Your definition of success could be sitting in a park bench and watching the birds and having the time to spend with family and relaxing in the you know, warm sun. So never equate somebody else's definition of happiness. But in a teamwork environment, it's always good to cheer up and appreciate someone who's got whatever little success and why. And if they have not, be compassionate about it. Feel for that person. Like, nobody wants to fail, right? Nobody signed up to do badly. So if they haven't been able to, it could be a skill issue, it could be a will issue, it could be a absolute coincidence or some random shit somewhere happened. The whole bunch of things happen, right? So be compassionate. And so you will see, once you as a manager exhibit this, your team will pick up this and the trust and respect among team members will start to build. Then next, if you overcome common collaboration challenges, common obstacles, right, which is, you know, the siloed mentality, lack of engagement, or, you know, conflicting priorities, or I have got somebody stayed back and sacrificed. I mean, a classical parallel example is for those of you who follow cricket, and I'll give you the analogy for who don't understand cricket, but for those who understand and follow Indian cricket more specifically. So we recently had the 5 test match series between England and India, and it was one of the marquee series. Like, it was one of the big draws. And so in marquee series, you expect the marquee players to turn up. And one such instance in this series, Mr. Virat Kohli, former India captain, did not play the entire series. He reprioritized his time away from cricket to be with family. Now, the world is absolutely polarized about it. The cricketing world, the Indian cricketing world, is polarized about it. One set of people think that it's absolutely fair if the man decides to be with the family. Why? Because he was attending to the birth of his second child, which is a life-changing moment. Cricketing tests will happen again the next year, but seeing the birth of your child is a one-off activity, right? So it's a no contest. It's a no-brainer. On the other hand, the other side of the coin felt that you are playing for the country. And it's in India, especially, cricket is just not a sport, right? It has transcended the level of sport. If of 1.4 billion people, I'd imagine at least a billion people follow the sport, of which at least 300, 400 million actively follow, of which say 100 million are absolutely mad about it. Now, if you just do the math, 100 million who are deeply avid followers, that is a huge density of people, right? So, and then you play for the country, that is of national pride. You are representing, and you know, all the history that we have with England. There's so many more angles to the story. So that part of the crowd thought, well, you could have certainly been there at the time of the birth, which you would have known, and maybe a day or two or whatever. You needn't have missed the entire series for it. And so we are, I mean, frankly, we are nobody to judge what Mr. Virat Kohli does and have no business commenting on his personal life. The only thing that we can comment about is his cricketing or his sports life. But that's the parallel I wanted to draw, that sometimes collaboration challenges happen. And for those who don't know, right, so we still landed up winning the test series without him. And I'm sure some part of him as a sports person would have felt the pain of not being able to contribute. He's a very passionate cricketer. And so for those who don't follow cricket, it's akin to being part of, you know, say, Super Bowl, and you're missing the Super Bowl, if not the final. Let's not say it's not like a World Cup final, but maybe the semifinals of the Super Bowl, right? You just kind of miss that to be with the family and say, oh, well, that's what I got to do. So that's how big it is all I'm saying, right? I don't know if Super Bowl has a semifinal. I'm sure it does. And so, but you get the drift, right? Missing a big marquee encounter. And so the collaboration challenges happen when the team says, hey, I too have a family. I stayed back late in the evening to finish this contract, to finish this deal. and you know, I work till 10:30 p.m. and here is this guy who switches off at 5, says my job is done, and so why is it that I stay back late and you don't say anything to the other person? And so these kind of real world situations come in between, because the guy who switches off at 5 says, I've got a kid to pick up from tuition class at 6, so I have to go. It's a non-negotiable. My wife is at work, she can't travel, I am the one who's closest to the school, and so I will go and pick up the child and have to bring back home. While you might say this is a one-off example, but the other guy who leaves at 5:30 says, well, I've got to be, my parents are visiting after a long time, so I have to be at home. So then this one chap says, you know, of the 5 people, if 4 of them have some quote-unquote valid reason to keep today's work to tomorrow, why are you expecting me to finish tomorrow's work today? And that poses a big collaboration challenge within the team. On one hand, you want to have a uniform task to everyone, right? If everybody stays till 6 o'clock, then everybody stays till 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock or whatever. If everybody has to leave, then everybody should be allowed to leave. If they want to stay back by their will, wish and choice, they can, but preferably they should switch off. But in the world that we live in, there are so many variants and variables that having this uniform parameter becomes very challenging for managers. So what do you do? So I would probably zoom out a little bit and say, here are some examples that there could be potential scenarios where you are expected to work late and finish while others might not. How would you be open to that? It's a question I would ask at the interview, right at the start. So start fixing or level setting expectations from an interview standpoint, from a recruitment standpoint, that how do you respond to the fact that you have a contract which is taking too long to finish, but others leave even if their contracts are not finished? How would you respond to that? How do you react to that? Engage that answer. They say, no, if everybody leaves, I leave too. And or the answer could be, no, I'll finish what I started out doing. And so sometimes it's important to develop that maturity within the team that, listen, we all are bound to be in situation where what is applicable to one person is not applicable to the other. So to that effect, it cannot be uniform. The other way of addressing it is, of course, plan better. Can you plan your work in such a way, streamline, optimize in such a way that you don't need to work till 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock in the night? And yes, there could be a one-off exception where it was unforeseen, but if it is happening repetitively, if it's happening again, then is there a way you can standardize the process, optimize the process so that nobody really needs to do more than their 9 hours or 8 hours, whatever they have signed up for? So even if you do that, you will still, as a people manager, find yourself in situations where there will be some amount of disagreement, discontentment that, well, this is not fair and all that. And so sometimes you have to help nurture the team members to rise above the current situation and then see that it does not happen repetitively again and again. Right? It has to be a one-off thing. And what is the best thing that you can do is to simplify and sensitize other team members how everybody's trying to get towards the common goal. So that's one way of ensuring that you overcome common collaboration challenges. Clearly tied to that, then is the next point, which is a culture of feedback and continuous improvement. Oftentimes, I've seen this in many, many organizations, and I've read many, many reviews where there's a thing called 360-degree feedback. So feedback people just empty the bucket. They just unpack, unload. Like, this is my time to give it back to the manager. And I'm going to go ballistic because A, it is anonymous. B, I know it's being read at skip levels. And C, I know HR or everyone is going to take action on it. So, which is a good thing, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But when people let emotions take the better of facts, that's where the problem is. There's an emotional outburst, and often misplaced outburst. Why? Because in defense of the people manager, I'd say sometimes they have to take harsh calls, difficult decisions. And the question to ask is, how would you have done it any different? How would you have approached the same situation differently? If there is an alternative way, why have you not communicated that? Why have you not requested that? And so I still think feedback or those 360 degree feedback is a good platform, but it cannot be used as a vengeance mechanism or a vengeance engine or a revenge machine, as it were, to unload an emotional outburst against your manager. That is, and it's incumbent upon the HRBP or the powers that be or the senior management to see through that part. And I know these are very tricky, very slippery situations where on one hand, the guy is, being honest and letting, there's no smoke without fire. And there must be some reason why this person is feeling in this particular way. That's one valid school of thought. But on the other, it's also true that sometimes immaturity takes the better of emotions, or because of immaturity, there's this emotional outburst. Sometimes it's not based on facts when you investigate deeply. And even the manager feels a little let down that, would you not trust what I'm saying? Why would you make me a manager? So feedback, while very important, has to be expressed in a mature manner, in a objective manner, in a balanced manner. And that's very important for a healthy functioning of the team. On the flip side, when you have, as an employee, given a very balanced, objective, fact-based feedback, and if the manager is getting super defensive about it, then that is not good for team collaboration at all. That is not good for team morale. It's not good for, if the manager, owing to the position of power and access and proximity, has this special quote-unquote relationship with their skip levels, and says, these people keep on cribbing, complain, and then nobody really in the management, nobody really listens to the team, or then that is a recipe for disaster as well. Because you've got to keep your ears to the ground what is happening. There are ways to do it. You cannot go skip level down as well, right? You cannot just remove the manager and talk to the team directly, which will undermine the position of the manager, right? Which is counterintuitive completely. The idea is to promote an open dialogue for both the parties to come sit across the table and speak in a civil, matured way and clear the doubt. You don't want the team to fail. You don't want the manager to fail. You don't want the team to fail. You don't want the business unit to fail, because that doesn't help nobody. And if you cannot do that as senior management or as HRBP, then that's something to think about, right? Why would you let that happen? Is it smart? Let's put it this way. Is it viable to suddenly let go of this manager and then hire someone new? And then again, the productivity gap, the ramp up, and there's no guarantee the same situation will not happen again. So why not fix it while you still can? And the same thing, so it cuts both ways. There could be a situation where the team member is just being immature about it. Absolutely, it's someone who is, there are people who don't understand, and those who don't want to understand. Now, I have all patience and empathy for a set of people who are unable to understand. It is important, it's paramount for the manager to explain as many times as it takes to help break down doubts, perceptions. But if the person doesn't want to deliberately understand? And you would ask the question, how do you know then that the person is deliberately doing it? Well, the answer lies in facts. Now, when you present, if a person has a perception or a doubt and you say, here are the facts of the case. If the person, despite knowing the facts, denies those facts and said, oh, this, I don't believe this, or yeah, there might be the facts, but I still have this doubt. That means they don't want to understand. They're not willing. They're not open. So that's, that is the difference there. And so balancing this out, this fostering this culture of feedback, that maturity lies not just with the team, but with the manager as well, and senior management as well, to know what the manager is trying to do. Sometimes, and it's mostly the case, right? Whenever, till such time you're having good love conversations, then people are happy. The moment you have a tough love conversation, then hell breaks loose. Then the manager becomes nasty. Then the manager becomes overbearing. And the manager becomes like all sorts of adjectives. But as long as, you know, there are fun and games and praises and appreciations, then the manager is very good. So one, there has to be the organizational maturity to understand that if a manager is trying to have a disciplinary conversation, fact-based, objective, you have to trust the manager's maturity to see it through. I'll give you a classic example of parenting, right? A parent is trying to teach a toddler to cycle for the first time without, you know, the support wheels. So parent A holds the bicycle from behind and lets the child navigate, but the child wobbles a little bit and falls a few meters ahead, falls to the ground, probably hurts themselves. And so this parent rushes and says, oh my god, let me pick you up. And then for the subsequent times keeps on holding. And so the child does not learn to independently get up. They will learn cycling, but to independently pick up when they have fallen is something that is missed. Whereas parent B is saying, okay, if the child has fallen, I will wait for the child to pick the cycle up, get themselves up and stand, and then I will go and help. Of course, one has to be reasonable with, you know, if the child is hurt badly, is bleeding and all that, okay, let him figure out, let him get up, then I'll go. No, it's not like that. But that sense of judgment has to be there as a parent. I'm sure you have, so I don't want to be more explicit there. But let the child learn to pick themselves up after they've fallen, and they learn a lifelong lesson that never stop if you've fallen down. It's a valuable lesson for lifelong. If while doing this, if there is a grandparent watching from behind and says, oh my God, what an insensitive parent you are, that you're letting your child fall and intervene and interfere and, you know, chide the parent and scold the parent and say, you nincompoop, I don't know how I brought you. I didn't bring you up like this. How come you're bringing up your child like that? It kind of messes with the system, isn't it? It's like it sends confusing signals to the child trying to learn to cycle. And so a very similar situation happens at the common workplace, where there are rights like HR, HRBP, LND, you have skip levels who definitely need to have an oversight on what's going on. Nothing wrong with that. But they also have to trust the manager to and learn what is the person trying to do, and course correct the manager if they are headed the wrong way or probably not doing it rightly. But if they're convinced about it, like, hey, here is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get the team to start work at 8:30. And if that means I'm levying a notional fine, as it were, and you have to do 5K more, you know, get 5 more leads or whatever, then they should allow that space for the team to get disciplined, rather than discipline the manager and say, hey, that's not what you need to do. So giving feedback, understanding where it's coming from, maturing the organization into having a meaningful feedback. And then it stems from the trust that you have developed in the previous point that I mentioned. If there is trust, then the feedback will always be open, clear, non-rhetorical. It'll always be normal. And if there is any area of improvement, either for the manager or the team member, they will work towards it positively. So think about it. But ensure that channel of communication for feedback to and fro is always open, as is the case of leadership's role in promoting this collaboration. Finally, the last part is of, you know, collaboration success stories. Now, there have been times when teams have not done well and they have just disintegrated completely. You know, it just, the pressure is too much to handle, to manage. But then there are times when the team has gone through difficulty, they have galvanized, they have unified together. And so it is very important to celebrate those moments, not just the end result that came out, but the journey towards the end result. So as a manager, it's important for you to document the stages of evolution, like a before and after. So when you go to your next QBR, say, here is how the team was before and now how it is right now. And here is where we are headed to. Here is what I am doing to make sure this collaborative effort results in a unified team with the better results. And so sometimes we miss that. We just talk about the end result, that, oh, I got the number, I didn't get the number. And yeah, credit to the team and all. But go deep dive into it and celebrate it. Celebrate the milestones. Celebrate the failures that, you know, oops, we tried this and we, you know, failed miserably, but we didn't stop. We picked ourselves up. And then we again marched forward and eventually got to where we are today. So I hope these points give you enough content, enough things to think about when you talk about fostering collaboration and communication within the team. So much of it is intertwined. I mean, I could probably have three other episodes just for this, but I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I did sharing it with you. I know I've missed a couple of weeks. I'm just out of bandwidth, absolutely out of bandwidth to do a justice, right? I don't want to do a shoddy job. So whenever I record an episode, I am whole soul, mind and body dedicated to this content. So I thought this content on team collaboration and communication is a very tricky one, and unfortunately most get it wrong. And so I'd love to hear some of your feedback, some of your thoughts on what works for you in your collaborative efforts, what communication styles work for you, what is a no-no for you. Maybe you can just share a couple of things that you don't want your managers to think or say to you. Love to hear some of your thoughts. You know where to reach me on. You can reach me on LinkedIn. That's India Neon, IN/INBAN, AAYANBAN. You can find me there on LinkedIn, or you could send a voice message. Scroll down below, there'll be a link. Leave me a voice message. You could reach me on X, that's IANISMS, that's hashtag AAYANISMS. Or you could go to the website www.bastalk.in. bustalk.in, and you could subscribe, like, share, they say, and of course leave me a message there as well. So any which way, if you're on Spotify, there'll be a poll. Write me a note or answer the poll. I will get some feedbacks and thoughts. Until we meet the next time, stay well, stay safe, keep listening to Bus Talk. This is your host Ayan, and I wish you a great week ahead.